This is talking with Wolfgang Priester on 30th August 76 at Grenoble. This is part two. Part one was 3 years ago. Now, before we covered your work that you did at Kiel, and you also told me in general about some theoretical work that was being done about that time on synchrotron emission and such in Germany. But can you tell me now about moving to Bonn and what you did at that time?
Yeah, around 53, 54, the Bonn Observatory decided to go into radio astronomy and to build a dish which was then considered the one which could be achieved. It would have been a 25-meter dish. And so the whole construction started. And since I was one who had been involved in radio astronomy, I got an offer and came to Bonn on the 1st of July 1955, just at the day when we decided on the location of the telescope.
I see. And what was that based on, the location?
The location, there was a problem with it, because at that time we couldn't get the money for radio astronomy alone. We had to share it with a radar research group. And for that reason, the telescope had to be put up on top of a mountain rather than put into a valley. We regretted that, but to have either the money or nothing, so we went along with that.
Who was the moving force behind getting radio astronomy going at Bonn?
Actually, this was Professor Friedrich Becker, the director of the observatory then.
Right.
And he retired in 66, and he lives in Munich now.
I see.
And the main aim, since the observatory was concerned with galactic research at that time, the main aim then was to go into 21-centimeter line radiation. While on the other hand, my personal interest more lay with the known thermal radiation and also with extragalactic objects.
Right. So what was the shortest wavelength that the dish was designed for?
It was designed for 21 centimeter and had been used later on at 11 centimeters and down to 6 centimeters.
Oh, wow.
But 11 centimeters is still a rather high efficiency, while at 6 centimeter it's going down already appreciably.
Were there any novel features in the design of this dish? Or?
I don't really know whether one can point that out. You have ever seen a picture of it?
Yes.
The idea was to have all the laboratory within the same building and use just the building as a basic construction to have this long pivot, you say in England, the vertical axis. And that proved to be a very excellent means to have that adjusted very easily. That was no problem whatsoever.
I see.
One funny thing of those days, which might be of interest, is that for mechanical reasons, of course, at that time, and that was an absolutely correct decision, we decided to make it an alt azimuth.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays there wouldn't be any discussion on that. But on the other hand, for astronomical following the stars, we had to convert to astronomical right ascension declination system. And at that time, of course, digital computers were not available, or they were so expensive, more than perhaps as expensive as an entire telescope. So this was out of a question. So we got a copy of the analog computer, a mechanical analog computer, which had been built in Dwingelo for the Dutch one.
I see.
And this was accurate for the 21 centimeter line work up to 1 minute of arc. It was just sufficient for that purpose.
Mm-hmm.
But there was also it was also clear that this analog computer could not be increased to increase efficiency more than factor of two or so anymore.
Yes.
So for any future work, one either had to rely on digital computers, which were at that time really not on the horizon so much.
Yeah.
And or one had to build it in a parallactic mountain. So the and you know about the problem of the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Green Bank. They decided at that time for the 42 meter dish, 140 foot, right, to build it in a parallactic mountain because of that problem.
An equatorial mountain.
Yeah, so, yeah. You might talk to John Finlay on that.
Because of the problem of the coordinate transfer.
Because of that problem of the coordinate transfer.
I mean, not transfer.
Conversion.
Conversion. Right.
Yeah. And. So this caused all that trouble with that dish.
With 140 foot, yeah.
With the 140 foot. So if that decision in Green Bank would have been taken a year or 2 years later.
That's right.
They would have made a completely different decision.
I think you're right there.
Yeah, Finlay was in Bonn all the time, or he came there twice a year or so, when this decision was pending, because we had finished already and had experience with this kind of construction, because the 140 foot dish in some sense is similar to the constructions, have one large
beton, yes,
concrete building and so on. So there were similarities.
I see. So was he an outside consultant for your dish, or just...
No, Hochhaut was a consultant. No, not even that. No, I'm mixing it up now. No, he was not a consultant.
He was just learning from your experience.
We exchanged views,
right,
of course.
Right.
And later on, when we started to building the 100-meter dish in Bonn, we went Hachenberg and myself and round, and now got the experience from Green Bank,
right,
back, and also got the experience from Parks.
Sure.
And also got the experience from the NASA dish in the Goldstone in the Mojave Desert. That was extremely helpful, and I'm sure that due to this, touring the world, going to Parks, going to Goldstone, going to Arecibo in around 1965, I'm sure for the construction of the 100 meter telescope that saved us about, I would say, between 5 and 10 million marks.
Really?
Yeah.
From what you learned?
Hmm?
From what you
learned
in that trip?
Certainly. I'm sure that we were able to put much more pressure on the companies in that respect and keep the prices down this way. This is the same thing what happens in space research, you know. Sometimes those satellites become extremely expensive,
mm-hmm,
because you really don't have a handle on how to
you can't compare it with anything and say, well, look,
prices down. This is... Mm-hmm.
Now, were there any special problems in the building of the dish, or did it go pretty smoothly?
That went pretty smoothly. All went on schedule, really. There was no major problem, really.
And so once you had the dish, then what do you do?
We started on 21 centimeter line work, and you have also on your list already a couple of papers that I published then, and then Peter Metzger came, and... I've forgotten the names of the other people who went out of
it. Well, there was this fellow, Graal.
Graal, he is still in Bonn with the 100-meter telescope.
You measured the position of Sagittarius A.
Yeah, for instance. Oh. And I don't recall all these papers. And at that time, I became interested in the cosmological aspects of radio source counts. And
What did you think of this whole controversy over the 2C survey and so forth?
Yeah, of course, at that time we had already the 3C, didn't we? Yes.
It came along in 59 or so.
Was it 59? No, it must have been earlier.
No?
Because my paper on radio source counts was finished in May 1958.
Right, it was published in 58.
Yeah, I finished it in May 58 because I had to, at that time, you know, in the meantime, the whole satellite blow up,
right,
let's put it that way, came about, which really immersed our institute, or my group at least, in that direction by accident.
How did that happen, you mean, by accident?
There were actually two things, in case you're interested. It has nothing to do really with radio astronomy.
Well, but if it got you out of radio astronomy, I'd like to know why.
I see, yeah. It didn't get me out, really. It just... made me schizophrenic in a certain sense.
Okay.
On the 5th of October, 57, one of our technicians in the radio lab came and said, there is a satellite in the air. And Nobody really believed it. He said, I have heard it on the radio. It's a Russian satellite and makes peep, 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 and I have heard it already.
Oh, yeah, I see.
So so we got interested in it. And then the newspaper men swarmed in when they learned that we were able to pick this peep, peep up.
Right.
So we decided if we listen to the peep, peep, we should also do some science with it. And that was a nice story. If you are interested in stories,
I certainly am.
These early days, we decided. Of course, first we had to measure what is the orbital period and things like that, and to measure the altitude when it came over. So we decided to make Doppler effect measurements. And about a couple of days later, let's see, this was on Friday, they launched it, perhaps on Thursday, I forgot.
It was Friday,
the 4th
of October. Friday, that's right.
4th of October, anyway. And on Monday or Tuesday, we had the first measurements. At the same time, our friends in Cambridge, Martin Ryle and his group, had Doppler measurements.
Right.
And they had... I don't know how this happens there, you have to inquire. But in some way or the other, a newspaperman got hold of the fact that they had derived the altitude when it passed over Cambridge to be 300 kilometers only.
Yes.
And if you remember that the Russians had announced this satellite is in an orbit of 950 kilometers.
I see.
They did, this was, this was the apogee altitude.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't say anything about that this was not a circular orbit and had a perigee altitude of only 220 kilometers.
I see.
So the entire world believed, the Russian never said that explicitly, but everybody, because they didn't say the other thing, everybody believed this is a circular orbit of 950 kilometers, which of course would have been a tremendous achievement as far as rocket power is concerned. All that talk about rocket power in those days, what the Russian secret fluid or whatever they use, or whatever it was, so there was lots of talk on that. The Cambridge people discovered it's only 300 kilometers high, and same happened to us. So,
did you know about each other's work at that time?
No,
came out in Nature.
There was no telephone contact. We read it in the newspaper.
Oh, I see, you read it in the newspaper.
Look, in the Nature paper of the Cambridge people, that took about a fortnight.
Yes.
It was very, very quick.
Yeah.
Quicker than anything before, but a fortnight at that time was a long time.
Right, right.
And when this newspaper announcement came, satellite is only 300 kilometers high, so it should come down within this week. So by that time we had figured out what the real orbit is. And the German, what they call Bundespressekonferenz, this is when some of the big politicians has an announcement, then they invite all the press, and they have a sort of a arrangement.
Yeah.
So these press people, they invited us to that Bundespressekonferenz on Wednesday after the 4th of October,
five days
after. And just during that night, we had figured out what the real orbit is. So I went and told them, look, there's no, of course, the Cambridge people are correct, the satellite is only 300 kilometers high when it passed over Europe. But there is no point to say it would come down. It's just that the Russians never announced that it is not a circular orbit, but it's an elliptic orbit, and the perigee altitude is even lower than 300 kilometers, only 220.
I see.
So next morning we had a nice headline in the German newspapers, Bonn and Moscow agree, because the Moscow people had also said the satellite will not come down so soon.
Oh, I see.
This has never happened again.
That Bonn and Moscow have agreed.
But of course, this was on science.
Did you know all the celestial mechanics, or did you just sort of have to...
I had learned celestial mechanics, so
I see.
Just as a student, really, never really went
at Cambridge,
it,
you know, they didn't know it at all. They had to...
They were
trying to learn it all.
I learned it along to use it,
yeah.
But I had learned it, I had class, and then I was a student on that.
But what about, we got talking about the log N, log S and all this. What was your view at that time as to how useful this was?
Now let me tell you this. So I had still this project on the log N log S problem. And but because of all the satellite problems, I had to go home and stay on sick leave.
to be away from the press?
Go away from the observatory just to do that paper, and I stayed home for, I don't know, 14 days or 3 weeks just to write this paper up, because I never got the time otherwise to do that. And in that paper, I discussed, at that time, you must remember, the 52 IAU meeting in Rome, when Walter Bader and Rudolf Minkowski announced, or at least, let's say, announced there was a collision of two galaxies which seemed to cause, in the case of Cygnus A, seemed to cause the radio radiation by plasma oscillations, what the idea was, or something like that. And by the way, when I met Minkowski in 61 and talked to him about that, then he said, look at our papers. You will never find a statement that we really talked about a collision. I don't know. I've never checked that.
Oh, no.
Unfortunately, Rudolf Minkowski died now already.
Yes, Walter Bader died. I have talked to him, though, before he died. But that's not true. There's colliding galaxies.
Yeah, but in the official papers in the APJ, I don't know whether he said that or not.
I think so. I actually have them in my room in the hotel. I can go back and check.
You can check that. Because
okay,
in 61...
well, that's what he said anyway.
At the IAU meeting in Berkeley, no, it was a special meeting in Santa Barbara.
Right.
We came about, and so I talked about this paper I published in 58 and looked into it and found out that the requirements for explaining, so I did the cosmological work, the NS from theory for all the different kinds of models with lambda equals zero. That, you know what that is, the Einstein lambda equals zero. For all these kind of models, I made all these calculations. And at that time, I didn't have a computer, so it was pretty, it was work to do. And then I checked the log N log S diagram with it. At that time, there was still the problem, is the slope 1.A or is it 1.5, is it curved, and all these kind of problems. But for any case, all the cosmological theories wouldn't fit in even with 1.5. So I guess I stated in that paper that if one would really would have it, I forgot the details really, I must say, if one would really have it, that the requirement would be that all radio galaxies would have been as strong as the standard object Cygnus A, which is the as far as absolute luminosity is concerned, still one of the biggest ones. And so so I said this collision business, even this collision, no, I compared this collision without collision. With collisions, since the collision number depends on the square of the number density of galaxies, you could get away with a steeper slope.
I see.
But the requirement would then be that they all had to be as strong as Cygnus A and so on. So I rejected it. I have forgotten the details, really. So
But you basically thought that the whole log N log S was a useful method.
At that time, I still thought it is,
To probe into...
Nowadays, you know, we have this enormous scatter.